Punya Ketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sivasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and outwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain his recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Oh, okay. Very good.
So, the question box is getting fatter. More questions. Okay. If you are sitting comfortably, then we'll begin. Oh my goodness. Okay, do it first of all. Whose is this one? No, I'm not going to do that to you. Here we go. Could you please explain the following Pali words? Chitto, mano, vijnana. The same. And I mention that because in the Brahmacara Sutta said that which they call chitta or mana or vijnana. And the way they put that, the grammar there, says they're alternatives. The reason is that in the time of the Buddha taught in a local language. In other words, he was not a lawyer. And not a great sort of philosopher where tiny words have tiny different meanings. So basically the way it was used was as synonyms. However, that sometimes the word mano is used especially for the sixth sense. That is the sense of mind. They always had six senses in Buddhism. And they also started off with six senses in Greek philosophy. Aristotle would always have the six senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing, or mind. And he'd always call that mind the sixth sense. He'd call it the common sense, because whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, your mind also knows. And having done the preparation, now comes the punchline. In the last 2,000 years of Western civilization, we've only got five senses left. We've lost our mind. We've abandoned our common sense. And there's a lot to say about that. So, also, that is mano, vijnana. It's always said there's six consciousnesses, six vijnanas, for each one of the senses. That's in the Buddhist teachings. And as far as citta is concerned, the mind is a general term. But do you want to know what the mind actually is? This was that logical argument from one of the friends I was at college with. We had a really amazing some of these friendships which you have. You always get some, always keep up those friendships, even though they may not be Buddhist. But I already mentioned one of those friends from university days, Bernard Carr, who was one of the chief supporters, workers with Stephen Hawkins. But also the other one was Mr. Jeff Perry, and he was also one of the three of us where we met and just hung out together, was as members of the Psychic Research Society at Cambridge. We went ghost hunting. But later on, when he sort of got married and he settled down, and that he was the father of this girl, only 5-6 years of age, grade one at school story. And it's a beautiful story because it answers many questions. "What's the biggest thing in the world?" her grade one teacher asked the class. "My daddy," said one kid. And if you've had a kid, your daddy, you know, as a little kid, your daddy is huge. "Hey, elephant, much bigger." "Hey, Ajahn Brahm, about the same size."
No, I didn't mess with that.
"Hey, mountain, much bigger than all of us." And the daughter of my friend from college days, "My eye is the biggest thing in the world," she said. That was really lateral thinking, thinking totally out of the box. And that was, wow, what do you mean by that? "Well," she argued, "my eye can see her daddy. My eye can see an elephant, a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be pretty large. It must be the biggest thing in the world. It could all fit in." A different perspective, and a very valid perspective. It was so interesting, he wrote and told me about that. And I said, 9 out of 10. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And it can imagine things you'll never see. It can hear sounds real and imaginary. It can smell, it can taste, and it can feel. And it's also got its own area of knowledge. If all of that can fit into your mind, then your mind must be the biggest thing. And I never said, in the world, because you can imagine, visualize, perceive the world inside your mind. So the mind is the biggest thing. It's a great argument from a 5-year-old kid. And it's so difficult to argue against that by looking at it a different way. So what is a citta? All this stuff can fit into it. The biggest thing in the world. In the Mahayana tradition, there are 8 consciousnesses. The seventh consciousness in mana. One is the seventh consciousness in Theravada. 6 consciousnesses is enough. But you know, I know this, Mahayana came after the time of the Buddha. Look, you've got to accept that because everyone understands that linguistically the evidence is compelling. But what happened, that the Mahayana, they invented the 6 paramitas. And then the Buddhists, the commentaries, they had to go one better, so they had 10. Paramitas. We've got more paramitas than you have. Na 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 na. It became a competition. Who's got the more consciousnesses? Who's got the more of this? But anyway, they have 8 consciousnesses, 7 consciousnesses. Mana. Mana is the same as citta vijnana according to the suttas. One is a 7th consciousness in Theravada. For the 8th consciousness, it is just, eh? For the 8th consciousness, it is. It doesn't say anything. Oh. Just simply act as a hard disk, store all information, and bring one to the next rebirth. I think you probably call that the alaya vijnana, but that is just the same as all these other vijnanas. Because when a person is reborn, or rather, in the stages between the births. They call it a manomayakaya, the body which is made of mind. So you can see, you can hear much stuff in that space, in the out-of-body experiences. So that consciousness is also just part of the manovijnana. So anyway, just as simply as a hard disk, store all info and bring one to the next rebirth. It says something similar nature in Theravada Nikaya. If not, where does all the info being stored. And now, that storing of information, why does it need to be stored somewhere? In a sense, that any time, any place in time that you can actually catch that information, you can see it here, you can see it here, you can see it on Wednesday, you can see it on Thursday afternoon, so it's stored there, always accessible. But it doesn't need to be stored like in a library. There is our fun. Sure, there's no physicists here. There's a phenomena called quantum entanglement, which is really weird because it's like two particles originate at one place and then they go to other ends of the universe, light years distant from one another. And then when one particle gets something happen to it, the other particle knows it straight away and also changes. How did that information get from one place to another in such infinite, instantaneously, when information can't go faster than the speed of light? So that had the quantum physicists so interested because they tested it, they proved it, it happens. So what is going on? What is going on is this mind, it is sometimes beyond time and space, which is one of the reasons why, as a mind, when you die, you can go anywhere instantaneously. Those stories about, you know, the nice stories about ghosts, that story, it's not uncommon, this experience, but this was a friend and a Buddhist, lived just around the corner from our city centre, and just, you know, he actually gave me permission to tell the story, because some of these things are personal. He said that he was just around the corner from the monastery, from the temple in Nonamara, in the middle of the night, living there alone, woke up in the middle of the night. Something weird was happening. Sometimes you realize something's going on in the room. He turned on the bedside lamp, and at the end of his bed was his mum, clear as, you know, looking at you right now. Not hazy, not some sort of apparition, but like a real mother there, just as she'd last seen him. But his mother lived in England, in Essex, and this was in Perth. And he said there was no words exchanged between them, but he just knew that his mum must be dead. And he wasn't at all scared. He said the only time he'd seen a ghost in his life, and he was just bathed in his mother's love. He said it was the most wonderful, tender experience. For about 5 or 6 minutes, not just a flash, but a long time, very clear, not imagining it. It was just, you know, right there, his mum smiling at him, just like, you know, a mother's love for her son. And he just smiled back. And he said 5 or 6 minutes of just sharing the last smiles and love, silently, didn't need to say anything. And then she just faded. Faded and disappeared. And of course, what happened next? What does an English man do when such a thing happens? Exactly, they have a cup of tea. You know, Ajahn Chah went to visit England once, and when he was visiting England, when he came back, we asked him, I remember being there at the time, and said, did you learn any English words when you were overseas? He said, oh yeah, what did you learn? Cup of tea, he said. That was the only word he remembered from his visit to England, because they always say, cup of tea, cup of tea. He's a very funny monk sometimes, Ajahn Chah. But anyway, so that, after having, well, he was still drinking the tea apparently, and the telephone rang, the old telephones, not the mobiles, some time ago. Pete, he said, I've got some bad news. Yeah, Mum's dead. What? How do you know? Oh, she's just come to visit me. And what was wonderful is that, in the sense that he couldn't be with her when she died, but he was with her afterwards, seeing her, smiling at her. He said it was one of the most precious experiences. He was not at all afraid, but like blessed, being able to see his mum. So that is the info. That is the nature of the mind, can do those things. Anyway, where does all the info being stored? In the mind. The other thing, I should say this, because some of you may get some really nice meditation on this retreat. You've only just started. One thing which you can do, which is really good fun, when I say good fun, I mean interesting, enjoyable, is when you have had a good, deep meditation, and you're coming out afterwards, you ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And if, you know, your mind is subtle enough, you know, developed enough, because you had a deep meditation, usually straight away, your mind will start to get some memories from a long time ago, a really long time ago, from previous lives sometimes. And no one can actually, you can't sort of convince anybody these things actually work, but if you have those experiences yourself, they come with some specific features. And one is that you know that that was you in a previous life. There's no doubt at all. And I think, you know, the reason is because the hindrances are gone, the doubt is gone. It's clear. In the same way that, you know that, you know, you've got the question box, oops. You've got the question box on a Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. So, clear. No doubt at all that this was you. And the other thing is, you have surprising information, which you didn't expect. But you check it out, and it comes out to be true. And also, if you want, if you remember, you can explore that past life. What was my name? Where was I staying? How old was I? Those memories can come back to you if you ask. A lot of times people just forget to get the details because it's just too interesting. Not at all scary, except, and this was the warning which a couple of people who did this method, recollecting their past lives, came across. They said, sometimes if you get a previous life, sometimes you get the most strongest memory from the previous life and the one which is closest to this life, your death. And sometimes people's deaths are, you know, are nice, reasonably peaceful. But many deaths are very painful for obvious reasons. So this man, he told me that, said, please warn people and don't even teach them it, he said, because I very clearly got a previous life experience. It was my past death experience. And it was really painful. And you're back there reliving it. And I said, oh, it's my fault, really. I should have given better instructions. The instruction is, if you do get an unpleasant experience, like your previous death, all you need to do is just say, earlier, please. It's just like, you know, what do you say on those machines, like rewind or fast forward or something? That's as easy as it is. You just press a little button in your brain or your mind, just earlier, please. And you go past the death moment to something earlier. And it can be very fascinating for you. No, because sometimes you wonder, where did I come from? Why have I got all these characteristics? Which, you know, I don't know where they came from. Anyway, there was one of our members, I won't say who it is. I think I can get away with this, that he was from Scotland. And He said ever since he was a kid, he knew how to fly aircraft. No training. He just knew how to do it. And it was always fascinating him. He could get into a sort of an aircraft and he just knew how to fly it. You know, without any training. And he was always really wondered why that was. And later on he just went through hypnotic regression. And he, you know, discovered that it was during the Second World War. He was a pilot of a flight which was going from UK to Gibraltar and crashed. And, you know, he remembered all the details. He let me listen to the tape recording of his memories under hypnosis. But then, you know, I'm not usually good on searching things on computers, but I had a free evening and so I started Gibraltar air crash in Second World War and I got it. The details of his crash in Gibraltar. There wasn't that many there. It was because the back of the tail plane was notoriously unreliable. So, you know, even you can find out the details. So, it's amazing what you can find out. And anyway, you mentioned about revulsion on Nibbida. Can you please give us some guidance on how to revulse? The word is how to revolt. If you want some guidance on how to revolt, you can go to Hong Kong. Well, this is like repelling, revolting. It means like revulsion means you just, what am I doing this for? Stupid. So anyway, how to get rid of defilements and bad karmas in our previous lives? You don't get rid of them. You make use of them. In other words, you learn from them. Sometimes people say, is the karmic result of past bad actions, is that punishment? I say, no, it's like learning. If you've ever been hungry and gone without food, is that a punishment? Or is that learning just what it's like to be hungry? So after that, you can never pass by a person who is starving. You just can't do it. You know what it feels like. It's your part of your experience. If you have, I don't know what else it is, you've killed somebody or been unkind to a person, then if you're wise, you know, you learn just what it's like, or sometimes you have to receive that, not as punishment, but so you learn what it must be like. So in that learning, it means that you grow. Anyway, next question. When it is said that we are owners of our karma, heir of our karma, karma understanding refers to volitional actions or intentions of physical, verbal, mental kind. Does it also refer to the energy created by these activities? It does also refer to the results of those actions, volitional actions. When others say everything has a vibrational energy, it doesn't all have a vibration. I don't say that. Can that also be referring to karma? There is things like absolute zero, which has no vibrational energy at all. In the deep meditations, all the vibrations cease and you become totally still. Does everything vibrate? No. There are some things which remain still for a while. Anyway, can we understand that volitional actions, vibrations, energy are the same references? Well, I don't know too much about vibrational energy, but volitional actions, yes. Or could the viparka, which is the karma viparka, yeah, the resultant of actions, be the vibrational energy that each of us experience? Well, the Buddha never talked about vibrational energy. So when it comes to karma, yeah, I know what he's talking about there. Dear Ajahn, what advice will you give to your Hong Kong followers? Oh, the youngsters are causing drastic damage to a country while hiding under the guise of fight for democracy. Hong Kong belongs to China. The faster they come to terms with it, the faster the nation will heal. China did a fantastic job in ignoring the antics of the youngsters in Hong Kong. They're now running out of ideas to hold their government to ransom. Well, actually, most of my Hong Kong followers, they don't qualify as youngsters. It's true, I've got to be honest to them. But the thing which, when I was a student, and I was as a posh university at Cambridge, and I always thought that I missed out on student experience because we never had a demonstration. We were just too well behaved, or too posh, too upper class, but not me. I came from a working class family, but there was one time there was going to be a student union strike. I think they had this, I don't really know what it's about, but it was a demonstration. Yes, at last I can do my student experience of having a demonstration. And of course you know what happened, my good karma, bad karma. You know, I wasn't always bored like this. I had long hair and a beard, very scruffy, and it's, you know, because you couldn't afford good clothes, quite honestly. So, but that was cool in those days. I led in fashion. I had holes in my jeans. I did. And I actually put patches on them myself because I couldn't afford any. Anyway, they had the demonstration. It was, where was it? In a big building in one of the faculties. Remember, I gave a talk there once to the Cambridge Buddhist Society, and it was the same building. No, wasn't it? No, not that one. It was opposite Newnham College, around there. Anyway, so we all were filing in to, you know, listen to people and demonstrate and stuff. And of course, the cameras was there, especially BBC, because, you know, Cambridge, because many people from BBC went to Cambridge, so they want to find out what's going on. And so they filmed the students going in. Many of those students were well dressed, but not me. So I was the one who appeared on the evening news. Well, I got into big trouble from that, for my family. You know, we sacrificed so you can get a good education, and we saw you this evening on the news. Now, my name was Peter as a young man. That was Peter there on the news. So they I said, well, there's many other students there. Why did they pick on me? Because I actually look like the rebellious, revolting student. I fitted the stereotype. That was the first time I got on TV and I got in trouble for it. But anyway, that's... when it came to any violence, that was the thing which I just couldn't take, and I just moved away. That is not sort of in my repertoire. If you have any violence, destruction, when you have maybe a legitimate cause, I think the authorities will just see the violence, will see the damage, and you will lose your support. So... violent demonstrations, somehow or other, I just can't see the good effect of it. There was one person was a religious person, and not in the Middle East, I think it was actually in the United States. There was an abortion clinic, and they said the right to life, and so they killed a doctor outside the abortion clinic. There was a disconnect there. Killing the doctor outside the abortion clinic. If you don't believe in killing, then why do you kill the doctor? Anyway, so for those youngsters or whatever causing drastic damage to a country, it will be whatever concerns people have. And it's better to listen to them, talk to them, But when you have a debate, if one side, whichever side it is, thinks that they are right and the other side is wrong, then of course there's going to be a problem. In any discussion, we always will have to actually to give in a few of what we want, the other side giving a bit of what they want. We may not both be satisfied, we're getting closer to solutions. Maybe the next time we can get a bit closer and a bit closer and a bit closer. That's the art of negotiation. But when there's violence, as people get injured and they get more and more angry, that's where big problems start. There were two sisters arguing over an orange. There was only one orange left in the kitchen. And one sister said, "You had the last orange, so this one is mine." But the other sister said, "But you had the last two, so I should have the last one and this one, to be fair." So they came to a compromise. They cut the only orange they had left in half. And one of the sisters peeled her half of the orange, ate the flesh, and threw the peel in the bin, the trash can. The other one peeled her orange, threw the flesh of the orange in the trash can because she was making a cake. She needed the rind, the peel, and put half the peel, you know, in her cake. If only they had talked to each other and found out, what do you really want? And then one sister could have had the whole flesh of an orange and the other sister could have the whole peel of the orange. And that was like a metaphor. You know, what does China want, the People's Republic of China? What does Hong Kong people want? What do you want? What do you really want? And sometimes it comes down to the different types of freedom. Sometimes you want the freedom to choose or the freedom, you know, from poverty. Sometimes the freedoms to choose, the freedom of desire, comes at a cost, because my desire may conflict with your desire. But in Buddhism, we have something else. We have the freedom from desire. Peace. What do you want? So the freedom from desire, I'll be talking about that later on during this retreat. That's something which no one on either side of this really understands. I'm happy, I don't need anything. Anyway, that gets too close to politics. And I became a monk to keep out of politics. It is interesting to note the mind chatter in the form of sounds and visuals and garbled conversations, even though it's dead quiet. Where did these come from? I know it is not for me. Ah, yes it is. You think it's not from you? Years ago when I was meditating, you got some distracting thoughts or fantasies. So that's not for me. But as you started to get more aware, your mindfulness picked up and got stronger, I thought, uh-oh, yeah, I choose to begin that fantasy or that stupid whatever it was. I was bored. I was not totally happy. I was not really content with my meditation, so you go and pick something out. It's the same phenomena that you go to your refrigerator and you say, is there anything to eat? And there's things falling out from the refrigerator. No, nothing to eat. You go on these channels on the TV, 62 channels, which is the same as the number of wrong views in the Dhammacara Sutta, by the way. And you look at all of the channels on there, no, nothing to look at, nothing on the TV. It doesn't matter how much choice you have there. When you're bored, anything. You pick up here, you pick up there. Something to distract you from the dullness and the dreariness of life, the disappointment of life. Something to excite you, to take your mind off things. And that's what happens when you're meditating. So, don't believe that this has come from somewhere else. You chose. You didn't see it happening. To disturb the quietness, the peace, and start to have some of these things coming into your mind. Because sometimes, you know, they can't hear anything. Women told me that sometimes that their husband is watching the football on the TV. And they say, darling, the dinner's ready, come on for dinner. They're not ignoring you. They can't hear you. Literally. They're right there in the sports match. So when that sort of thing happens, just you can focus in on something. If they can only do that with the breath, so they wouldn't hear any mind chatter at all, because they're really absorbed and engaged in what's happening in the mind. And then sounds and visuals just don't happen at all. There's no chatter, because you're enjoying yourself. Is there such a thing as forgiveness meditation? Of course there is. Please forgive me for not describing it. Sorry?
Loving kindness,
but you can actually do a forgiveness, because we just did the end of the rains retreat ceremony. We all ask forgiveness of one another. We actually just do even a little ceremony. Whatever I have done by body, speech, or mind, intentional or unintentional, by an act of by doing something or forgetting to do something, I ask your forgiveness. And then if you ask forgiveness like that, according to Buddhism, you have to give it. And the other person says it back, whatever I've done by body, speech and mind, intentional or unintentional, on purpose or things I should have done which I forgot to do, please forgive me. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. But I want to learn from mistakes. So that means that you give forgiveness and you ask forgiveness. And that way, there's this beautiful sense of growing and learning. And a good example of that also is many years ago, when my predecessor Ajahn Chah disrobed and I took over as the abbot. You know, whenever you take over as a boss, you're always really strict. You know, you just really just want to impress everybody. So, one afternoon I was walking just by the main hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, and I saw a hammer which was going rusty, left in the grass. And I thought, that is just not appropriate. As monks, we live on the donations, the charity of our supporters. And some of our supporters I knew were just really poor, but they would actually save up to buy a hammer so that they could help, you know, build our monastery. And some sort of heedless, forgetful, just ungrateful monk or novice or even Anagarika had left that hammer out in the grass and it was getting rusty. And I thought, this is just not acceptable. You have to make a stand. And so I called a meeting. And when I gave the talk that evening, it wasn't just all this nice, you know, open the door of your heart, just two bad bricks in a wall, just No, I really didn't let them have it. I was going to say I hammered them, but that's not properly right. And afterwards, I realized I must have done it too fiercely. Because all the monks, none of them were slumping or getting sleepy. They were all sitting up dead straight. And then said, "Who's responsible?" No one put their hand up. No one. And I thought, I must have laid it on too harshly. There must have been all afraid. It must have been somebody. And I actually left that hall disappointed. And maybe I was too strict, but at least somebody should have, you know, acknowledged who it was. You know, to actually to confess, to be honest. And that's what we're supposed to be as monks, you know, to let people know who did what. And I just went outside the hall first, and just as I got outside of the hall, it hit me, I remembered who left the hammer. It was me. I was the one who left it out there. But I'd forgotten totally about it. I always meant to sort of pick it up later on and put it away, but I totally forgot it. That it was me, and it was just after I'd really blasted and harangued my monks. It was so embarrassing. So I turned around and said, "Could you just hold on for a few minutes?" I found out who left the hammer in the grass. It was me. And so I apologized for two things: leaving the hammer out of the grass and forgetting and just blaming other people. So that I was reminded that by that. That was just a really good lesson for me. So sometimes we blame other people, we find that it was you. So because of that, forgiveness is a beautiful part of our life. Okay. What is attention in the sutta, and how do... Actually, when there is forgiveness, you tend to make less mistakes. Because when you don't forgive, you hide the truth. No one wants to tell what really happened because you get into trouble and there's no way out. So what was it? There was a big trial in the United States. Somebody was accused of murder, and if found guilty, would face the death penalty. And so when the accused was giving his evidence that, you know, it was, you know, looked like he was lying. And so the judge interrupted and said, "Sir, you know, be honest, because in this state the penalties for perjury, for lying under oath, are very serious." And the defendant said, "Yes, Your Honor, but the penalties for perjury are far less than the penalties for admitting you actually did the killing." So in other words, that's why people lie. You lie because the penalty is far less than if you tell the truth. Which is why we want to turn that around. As long as you tell the truth, you'll be forgiven, amnesty. If you lie, then that is a bad karma, really bad karma. So that's why telling the truth, and in a relationship, in a partnership, for goodness sake, have your partner, the one person in this world you can tell the truth to, without fear. To tell them that, look, I make mistakes, but I'm always going to be honest with you. So if I do make a big mistake, please don't hit me. I'm telling you so you can help me, because I value our partnership. Otherwise, there'll be hidden truths in your relationship, things which you're hiding from your partner, because telling her or him is worse than keeping it secret. It's a terrible state of affairs. That's why honesty should always come with forgiveness, with amnesty. What is attention in the sutta, and how to direct the most elusive and important commodity. Attention. It is attention if you want to direct it. Sometimes you have to strengthen it first of all. So the attention is really strong. So when you pay attention, you can actually see deeply into it. Just like the story I said on the first night or morning about the walking up the hillside. My attention on that morning was so strong, you could see almost everything there. Even if you directed it, but it wasn't strong enough, yeah, you can see the rock, but you can't see it fully enough. You can't see what's around it. So first of all, strengthen your attention. Once you have this direct attention, automatically it will go to the interesting stuff, the fascinating stuff, especially the joyful stuff. The attention goes to what's attractive. It gets pulled towards that. If I give a very boring talk, you can see people's attention just vanishes and goes other places, which is always the reason why whenever I look at people's faces and the attention is disappearing, I always think that is the time for a joke. To keep people's attention, or a ghost story, or who knows, maybe sometimes both. Do you remember the story of one of the Australian women went on holiday to UK? And when you go to an old country like England, you always want to visit the castles, the really old castles, 1,000 years old castles. And so she went to one of the castles, and the guide took her on a tour of the dungeons. And in those dungeons, many bad things were done. People were killed, tortured, locked away for years. And even though she did not believe in ghosts, still it was cold and spooky and dark. And every time she trod on these floorboards, it made strange noises. Every time they passed an open window, yeah, that's right. And every time they opened the door, and even though she was a hard-nosed scientist, she didn't believe in any of this ghosts and specters stuff. Still, when she got out at the end of the tour, she was relieved it was all over. She was out in the sunshine. But she couldn't help but ask the guide, "Have you ever seen a ghost in these dungeons?" And the guide replied with sincerity, "In all the years I've been living in this castle, I've never ever seen a ghost." She was relieved, but she had to ask the other question. "How long have you been living in this castle?" "Over 300 years, he said. Okay. I have got to the stage where my breathing is refined, and that I fear whether I'm breathing or not. It is pleasant feeling, yet there's a sense of fear. How do I get past this? In all the years I've been living at Chattagong and teaching here, no one has ever died. No one has ever gone cuckoo. No one, but many people have become much better people, wiser, more peaceful. So, I have a perfect track record on teaching these retreats. either here or in UK or anywhere, or in Singapore. So you have nothing to worry about. No fear, Ajahn Brahm is here. So you have fear sometimes comes up, but it's totally irrational fear. And it's also, the fear is just whenever you're about to let go of an attachment, you're always afraid of what it's like to let go. The same sort of fear which prisoners have when they're about to get released. They got used to staying in jail. Going to freedom. I don't know if I can cope. So what do we do with prisoners? They don't just, you know, here you are, well done, off you go, best of luck in the outside world. They just get day release first of all. And then maybe weekend release. And then maybe parole. Little by little, step by step. In the same way that when you meditate, you get release step by step. First of all, delightful breath. Then maybe nimitta. Then maybe the jhana. And then you come back again into the world. You get step-by-step release. So you don't get too scared. You know, you always come back again. So it's okay, just get out for a while. And after a while, when you're free of prison, hey, this is really good. Who wants to go back into prison again? So that's how it works. How important is general happiness in one's worldly life for beginning the process of causality explained this afternoon? Yes, pretty good. Why not? For example, one may not have regret based on poor sila, but on other things, such as whether one has made good choices. Ah, life is ineffable. Have you heard that word before? You've heard ineffable. Ineffable is a word which I don't know what it means, because ineffable describes what is indescribable. So even ineffable is indescribable, because that's what it means. It means you can't explain it. That's meaning ineffable, inexplainable. And I thought, just what a useless word that is. So to make the word more useful, change one letter from ineffable to ineffable. What does that mean? You can't if the past. If I hadn't made that choice. You know, one of the talk about fear, one of the scariest moments in my life, even remembering it gives me shivers. I was at the marriage of one of my friends at Cambridge. And at the end of the marriage, the guys were just hanging around talking stupid stuff to one another. And we got on to the conversation, who'll be next? And the first person I pointed to was that Jeff Perry, the father of that incredibly smart girl who understood the mind is the biggest thing in the world. I said, oh, he'll be the next. And the guys looked at each other and said, yeah, nah, no one would marry him. And the next one they pointed to was me. They said, no, Pete, he'll be next. And then they looked at me and said, nah, no girl will marry you. And at that point, there was a girl standing right next to me. And she whispered in my ear, I would. Ah! I was terrified. That's pretty unfair and all that, but you know, if I hadn't have just run away so quickly and got so afraid, what might have happened? Would I become a monk? How can you if the past? You don't know what might have happened if you made another choice, if you go in another direction. You go out the door, you turn left. You go out the door, you turn right, what would have happened? Sometimes it always goes round and meets again, whichever way you go, you end up with just following your karma. But from that time on, or this time, you don't think what might have happened if I'd have made a different choice. It might have been much worse. It might have been much better, who knows? So that's why never if the past. Okay, on things such as whether one has made good choices. Good choice, bad choice has been made. One may be very stressed and therefore unhappy. Stressed? You can still be stressed and be happy. Well, I do a lot of work stressing out, but you can still enjoy life. There was somebody sent me an article, a psychologist, about executives in high-stress jobs. And they found out, this really smart psychologist, doctor, just got permission to check their cardiac health. And they found their cardiac health had nothing to do with the stress of their position, but everything to do with the way they looked and dealt with their stress. For those who enjoyed it as a challenge, who actually related to it in a positive way, let's give this a go. It's doing something good for the world. Let's try it out. They still work really hard. But otherwise, people have said, oh, why me? Why do I have to do this? This is unfair. 80% of the work is done by 20% of the nuns. Is that right? And you always say that. 80% of the work is done by 20% of the workforce. In other words, sometimes people take a huge proportion of the work, and others don't do much at all. Freeloaders. But you know what I was told by Ajahn Chah? Those people who don't do that much, they're missing out the opportunity of making good karma. I can do it instead. So if there was something to be done, like sweeping, sometimes we'd run, see who would get the broom first of all. Yay! I know it's not my turn to sweep, but today I'm going to sweep, because I need the good karma. So you do more work than you're allowed, or you're supposed to do. Not out of stress. Not, why do I have to do this? This is unfair. I didn't become a monk to be a labourer. I didn't become a nun to be an administrator. I didn't be... He said, no, yay! A nice, more... a thing which I can test myself out with. So the attitude towards the work, they found that that was what was more predictive of bad cardiac health, your attitude to what you were doing. So that's, you're very stressed, therefore unhappy. That is a non sequitur. Not just because you're stressed you have to be unhappy. You're stressed, which means you're doing a lot of work, which means you're extending your abilities, your boundaries, stretching yourself. Have you ever been to the gym? It's stress. You're stretching your muscles. That's what I think they do. I only look through the window and see what they do. That's stress. But is that good for you, pushing weights, extending your... stretching your boundaries? That's stress. What's the difference between that and the stress of a job? Making something happen for a good cause. Sometimes you find, I've found this, that people actually work harder for charity than if it's, you know, for a company. Simply because they feel that it's really a worthwhile thing to do. So you can still be happy and work hard too. So you just change your attitude to what you're doing. Dear Ajahn, I'm a first timer here and didn't know it would be so hard to get a Wi-Fi signal. You can get a jhana signal. You can get a peace signal. The enforced digital detox is great, but I know my mind will start worrying about work once Monday starts. How do I deal with this? Is stay here until Tuesday? In other words, have another day. And you will find, just give it a try. When work, when Monday starts, you will find that your company or your job is going quite well without you. It doesn't mean you're going to next and say, oh, I don't have to worry about the work. And then you start worrying about, well, if it's going so well without me, maybe the boss might sack me. Unless you're the boss, and you sack yourself. But you can't really do that. I've tried that many times. It won't let me get the sack. Anyway, so you can worry about anything. But what is brilliant about this is once you've had a good rest, then afterwards you go back to work and you find that you've got so many more ideas, you relax, you're rested, you're energized, and you're a far more efficient, good worker. And many years ago, when I was on one of the internal flights in Thailand, that again I picked up the Bangkok Post, and there was an article there about the Oriental Hotel over in Bangkok. I've actually never stayed at the Oriental Hotel. We had like a disciple over there who was one of the managers, so I gave a talk over there, and they gave me lunch beforehand, as they do to monks, and they have the best onion soup in the world. If ever you like onion soup, Oriental Hotel. Recommended by Ajahn Brahm. Of course, I don't know how expensive it is, because being a monk or a nun, they give it to you for free. But anyway, when I was talking about onion soup, anyway. Sorry?
You read Bangkok Post,
exactly, yes. And the thing is, you only get distracted, especially if you get distracted by onion soup. Because that wasn't ordinary onion soup, that was famous throughout the world for its onion soup. But anyway, they had won the prize for the best hotel in the world that year. Number one hotel. And it always was like a really posh hotel, but this was number one. And they interviewed the manager or the owner or whatever. I think it was the manager. Why did you get the award this year? You know what he said? And the reason I say this is because he would send every one of his staff, you know, from the cleaner to the concierge to the onion soup chef to everybody, to a monastery for 7 days for a retreat at the hotel's expense. Not taken off their leave or their holidays, part of their corporate training. And they send them to this monastery. It was actually Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. Send them there for a week, you know, not at the same time, obviously, on a roster. And as a result of that, they had far less sick leave, far less attrition, you know, the people leaving and having to hire and train new people. They were far more relaxed and sensitive to their guests, which in the hospitality industry is really important. Just even to smile at people. When I went to Thailand the first time, it was on, Soviet Airlines, with the Aeroflot. The cheapest ticket, it was in 672 or 3 or something. And from the London to Moscow, and then from Moscow to Thailand, to Bangkok, halfway on the flight, they hadn't offered me anything. So this flight attendant passed by and I said, could I have a cup of tea, please? And she looked at me and said, "Nyet!" I've never seen in-flight service like that before, and I don't want to see it again. I was terrified. Because they weren't like the petite, you know, sort of air flight attendants these days. She was like built like a Russian weightlifter. It was really scary. That was my first experience of long-haul flight attendants. Anyway, okay. So for service, just going to the monastery. You know, I wish they'd sent, Lufthansa had sent their flight attendants to that monastery. And then they said, yes, sir, what type of tea would you like? But this is actually where you can relax, and it's good for business. So that's why it got the top hotel in the world that year. And he said that was the main reason. Sending people to relax in a meditation retreat at the company's expense. Another one. I am a first timer here. Okay, that's pretty much the same writing, but not quite. How do you suggest I get the most out of this week? You said no messages. Anything else? Keep to a roster of meditation. Nah. Dharma talks or exercise? Nah. Your advice, as always, is manna. Manna is like the thing from heaven. So, you're here for the first time. Remember to relax to the max while you're here. Check your peace-o-meter. We have thermometers. We have barometers. What a barometer! That's the pressure. We have anemometers. That's the wind speed. Am I right here? I don't know. But we are speedometers. Yes, you know about speedometers. But this is the peaceometer. So a speedometer may go from 1 to 100 miles per hour. And the peaceometer, that is in your brain. How peaceful are you? From 0 to 100. Give it a number. Now, what moves the needle of your peaceometer up closer to 100, which is frantic, which is crazy, which is almost psychotic? Right up there. And what moves it down close to 0? What makes you peaceful? And what makes you disturbed? So learn that one. Learn how to relax to the max. How you can become so peaceful anytime, any place. What is the cause of peace? And you'll find a lot of times the cause of peace is letting go of the past and future, just being here, and not really trying to achieve anything or do anything. Sometimes in this retreat center, the most peaceful experience you'll ever have is just sitting in front of the dining room with a cup of tea or coffee or whatever you like, just watching the sunset. With nothing to achieve in the whole world. Not trying to get anywhere. When you're trying to meditate, you're trying to achieve something, that's stress. When you actually give up and let go, and then things come to you. You can have one. No, allow me to make some merit and good karma. Even if you don't want to sneeze, just make a sneeze. Thank you. That's good karma. So learning just how to relax and be peaceful. Can you actually see your peaceometer go up and go down? When you become aware of your peaceometer, then you have a good little tool to actually, for a first timer or for a many timer, to actually to understand how this meditation works. Next one. You know where you got your coughs from, don't you? Because you all come through airports. It's called terminal disease. It's not going to kill you, but you know, you're traveling around, exposing yourself to all sorts of bugs. So anyway, so relax to the max. So you don't need to sort of do too much coughing. Can a lay person with a regular job become enlightened? If yes, how? Easy. Just lay people in the time the Buddha became enlightened, but you'll tend to lose your hair. And with a regular job, well, I've got a regular job, teaching meditation. So if I'm a lay person, well, I do lay around a bit. Yes, you can, but there are consequences. But it's easier as a monastic. Can you travel from Perth to Canberra by foot? Can you walk there? You can walk there. It's possible. But for goodness sake, get an aircraft. It's much cheaper and more comfortable. It doesn't cost that much. So yes, you can, as a lay person, become enlightened, but just for a few extra pence, you can go on Buddha Air, otherwise known as a Sangha. That's why the Buddha made the Sangha, so it's an easy way to get enlightened. Regarding today's sutta class, why is it described as tears of pity when it is joy and happiness when we enter temples, holy lands, etc.? Oh, sometimes it's tears of pity as well when you enter holy places. Depends on their power, and sometimes even recognition. Now, some people have said this, that sometimes you go to a place and something really hits you really hard. There was this dear old lady. This doesn't mind me saying her name. It's Barbara and Ainsley. They used to do some of the helping and banking the money for us many years ago. They get a bit old now. But he was really a Buddhist, and she was actually, I think, a Christian before. But eventually she became a Buddhist, and this is one of the reasons why. She was from Cornwall. He was an Anglo-Indian. And he's very nice fellow. And she's a very nice girl, in her 80s now. But anyway, they decided to go on pilgrimage to India. And I was giving her the briefing beforehand. She says, some of these places are very powerful. I told the story of the Dhammacakka Buddha statue in just outside of Sarnath. And I told her, I said, some of these places are emotionally charged, and if you feel like crying, because you get so inspired, please do so. It's part of the pilgrimage. And apparently, at the time, she said, what a load of... I introduced a word for the first time, gomayang. Gomayang is a Pali word. Go is a Pali word for bull. Mayang is what comes up out of the backside of a bull. So you understand what it means? Yeah, but people get upset when I say it, but it's okay for you to say it. So I say it's gomayang. So she thought, there's a lot of gomayang. I've been in England, I grew up there, there's so many ancient castles and ruins. We're only just going to ruins of old-time things, and so it's just another sort of archaeological, historical trip. There's nothing really there. And the first night, landing in Gaya, and then going to Bodh Gaya, the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. She was like, oh, this is interesting archaeological stuff. And as soon as she went in the table, she couldn't stop weeping. She really wept. And that's why in the evening she came up to me and said sorry, she asked forgiveness. So I thought this was madness, craziness. You say that old ruins would affect us so much, but it did. And so I didn't understand just the power of some of these places. So she really wept, and it was totally unexpected. So some of these places do have great powers. Sometimes it's deep memories from the past. You say there is no self. I didn't say that. My five khandhas did. But in the suttas, the Buddha said, if we were to have this view, we would be with the ascetics who teach nihilism. No, that's not what the Buddha said. If you understand that there's five khandhas, this is process. You can't say there's nothing, but you can't say there's something. It's a third option of a process rather than nothing. So this is actually the clarification. That's in the Kacchanagota Sutta in the Nidana Samyutta, and that became one of the most famous suttas because it was Nagarjuna based that to get the Majjhimaka philosophy, which is, some people said it's, you know, part of Mahayana, but you know, it started off with just quoting and basing the whole thing on a Buddhist sutta. Not nothing, not something existing. It's almost like being halfway between existence and non-existence, a process, a cause and effect. Empty conditions roll on without a self inside. More science for you. Sometimes we have something in physics. It's a very easy to understand little law, the conservation of mass energy. You can't create mass energy, you can't destroy it. Like mass can turn into energy, which is, you know, sometimes the nuclear fission, or you know, nuclear bombs, or mass energy can change this way and that way, but you can't create or destroy it. So, where did all this stuff come from? And the answer is, and I was just doing this in the in front of the professor of physics at UWA one day. And I said, well, my understanding of this is there is such a thing, you know, in science, in the universe, called negative energy. I don't mean a bad emotion. I mean that things like a piece of mass in a field of energy, like you in the Earth's gravitational field, to get you free from this gravitational field, to send you out in space, takes a lot of energy. So, you know, your what they call potential energy, if you remember from school, is a form of negative energy. So I said, what would happen if the sum total of positive energy in the whole universe, together with the negative energy, if they all came together, would they perfectly cancel each other out? And he looked at me in this moment I will never forget. He said, wow. Ajahn Brahm, you are so up to date. Omega equals one. He never explained what omega was, but apparently it does equal one. And this universe totally balanced. So if you catch all of the stuff of this universe, every piece of matter, and bring it all together, it wouldn't explode. It would just perfectly cancel itself out. There'd be nothing left. Now, the thing you call your mental processes. If you can carry all that together, it would perfectly cancel itself out. It's not destroying anything. It's a balancing, the zero sum of the universe. I thought that was really cool. You can't destroy things. You can't create things. They're just a balance of energies, from nothing to nothing. And here we are, somewhere in between. Anyway, when you say that it's just a process, not a self, yeah, or essential entity, is it a process that is the nature of dukkha because of the nature of anicca? Yeah, that is unfitting to say there's a self. Yeah, it's, can you control your happiness and suffering? Look at, we've got the aircon in the back. Are you too cold? Too hot? What about, is it too late? Are you tired? Do you want to go to bed? Of course you can go to bed. Off you go. But people feel, oh, I can't go until Ajahn Brahm lets us go. This is not a school. I won't put you in the corner tomorrow and send you to the principal's office, give you detention. If you're tired, please have a rest. But in the... what does it say? Okay. That life is uncontrollable. Okay, I may not finish all the questions this evening, but it comes up to the story of the driverless bus. I wish I was more, I had a business manager. I should have had a business manager when I was very young. Because I had all these great ideas. The simile of the driverless bus, that came to me so many years before Google got its idea. And I could have actually patented that and made a fortune. Don't know what I'd done with the fortune anyway, but being a monk, don't need it. But anyway, the driverless bus simile. Life is like being on a bus journey. That's pretty sort of, you know, usual. But on your bus journey, you're sitting on your seat, looking through the window, and sometimes your bus, your life goes through the toxic waste dumps of life. Really painful, really distressing. Everything you work for falls apart. You know, you have the divorces and the breakups, and that really hurts you deepest inside. And you tell the bus driver, put your feet down on the accelerator. Let's get out of here. This hurts. What does your bus driver do? He puts on the brake, slows down. So all the difficult times of your life, you have to endure longer than is really acceptable. All because of the stupid bus driver doesn't know how to drive the bus. And other times, you go through the beautiful heavenly scenery of rolling hills and scenic waterfalls and mountains of life. And it's so beautiful when you're looking through the window, having such a happy time looking at the great scenery. And you tell the bus driver, slow down, park, this is wonderful, I want to enjoy this as long as I possibly can. And what does your bus driver do?
Speed up,
yeah. So it stops where it should speed and speeds when it should stop. So your suffering lasts longer than it should. And your happiness just passes by too quickly. And why? Because your bus driver doesn't know how to drive a bus. And of course, that is your will, is a bus driver. Your choices. Stupid choices. Which means you have to suffer much more than necessary. Why did I do this? So that's why many people come to spiritual practices. They just want to teach their bus driver how to drive more efficiently, to have more happiness and less suffering. But then, to instruct your bus driver, you've got to find a bus driver first of all. And that's the job of meditation. To leave your seat, your body, and go to that part of you which is the controlling mechanism. It, deep inside your mind, the will. Did you choose to come on this retreat? Really, who did? The will chose, but you know what the will was? Why you came? So, eventually, you get out of your seat and you go up the bus to the bus driver's seat. And when you get to your bus driver's seat, it's not what you expected. It's not what you thought. When you get to your bus driver's seat, you find there's no one sitting there. It's empty. The driverless bus. So, what's the consequence of that? You go back to your seat on the bus and you stop complaining. No more wanting or ill will. Because there's no one to complain to. End of problem. Hee hee hee. Anyway, maybe it's getting closer. Maybe make this the last of the questions, because I'm getting tired too. Is this one here? Okay, I'll do these two questions. My friend, a convert to Buddhism. A convert? It's all changed. You know, sometimes that people... This was Dr. K.C. Dharmananda. He was telling me that over in Malaysia, and also Singapore, many people trying to convert the Buddhists to being Christians. And maybe your old auntie had been a Buddhist for all her life, but then her grandchild or something knew the pastor, and the pastor said, oh, if they carry on as a Buddhist, they go to hell. So you've got to convert her at all costs. We've got to convert them. So they would be around the bedside, chanting and cajoling. And imagine that when you're trying to die. And you get all your people just, oh, come on, convert, convert, convert. So I remember Dr. K.C. Dharmananda asked me, just, what would you do? Any advice? I said, easy, yeah, of course. If that's your nieces and nephews or something asking you to convert, convert to being a Christian. Hallelujah. And then once they've converted you, they'll leave the room. And as soon as they leave the room, Buddhang Savanangachami, Dhammang Savanangachami, convert back again. That's the only way you can find some peace. He had the same response. He thought it was very funny. But it's also very practical too. Because otherwise they'd be at your bedside all day and all night until they've converted you. They will never go away. So let them convert you first of all. When they're gone, okay, they're gone now. Abhi tofu. Whatever. Anyway, now full-time Dharma teacher and practitioner told me that he has had the jhanas, but he's not getting any further in his practice. I don't think he really had the jhanas, otherwise he wouldn't say it like that. He said the Hindu ascetics had the jhanas. Did they? I don't think they did. That's what people say, but if you actually check them out, probably not. If you want to be liberated from suffering, any advice on how to proceed further, make sure that you really got the real jhanas, not the fake ones. Because a lot of times people go around and they're not really the real jhanas. And if afterwards you'll have so much power, then you can use that to end suffering. When I was new to Buddhism 19 years ago, someone told me that Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, is like a sunlight casted from Vairochana Buddha, which is likened to the sun. In Chinese, Vairochana is rendered the great sun Buddha. Is that correct? No. That's an easy one. People make it so complicated. And they try just and make it just some things which you can never check on because they're just too hard to understand. You're not saying that Theravada is free from embellishment. They made lots of embellishments. You know, just like, you know, thinking that the Buddha would never washed or bathed, didn't need to because his skin was pure. He went to have a bath, cut his hair. But sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't say such things. It's, what it's called is hagiography. When you have a teacher that after a while, especially after they die, that you add psychic powers to them, that you make them bigger than they really were. And the reason is, you know, because, you know, you committed to a teacher, so if your friend's teacher's got psychic powers, then my teacher must have more psychic powers than you have. It becomes like that pride and comparisons. And that is really terrible. So, it is, people start adding stuff. And even this happens before a person dies. And this happened to Ajahn Chah very quickly, because it's almost 9:30. Abdu Ajahn Chah, when he was still alive, and I know the story so well, his monastery, Wat Pa Pong, was a forest. He was starting to get famous, and on the moon nights he would give a talk. This was during the rains retreat. It was monsoon season. And so a wealthy family from Ubon had travelled in their car to Wat Pa Phong. It was raining so hard, they got stuck on the way into the monastery, the road into the monastery. And they wondered what to do. They didn't really want to get wet by going outside. And what did they see? Ajahn Chah came out from the forest and was so humble. Who pushed their car out of the mud so they could get to the temple. Now what a humble, sacrificing gesture that was from the head of the monastery, Ajahn Chah. And they saw it very clearly. And when they got, just maybe 5 minutes later, or even less than that, 2 minutes later, to the hall, and they went into the hall to listen to the talk, there was Ajahn Chah seated. No mud on him, no wet, perfectly dry. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. A psychic power they'd seen with their own eyes. However, the truth of the matter was, Ajahn Chah had a cousin who was a novice at the time, and then now he's Ajahn Paitu. I know him really well. And he kept saying, no, it was me. I was a novice, I wasn't actually in the meeting. I saw the car get stuck and so I helped. But, you know, in the rain, in the dark, you know, he said, oh, that's Ajahn Chah. And doesn't matter how many times he said, no, look, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was me. Yeah, you would say that, wouldn't you? So to try and keep the reputation of a humble teacher. And they could see that happening. That, you know, it's just people just wanting to believe in their teacher. And want to have psychic powers. So, be careful. It's called hagiography. And it got so bad with Ajahn Chah. This, again, is no exaggeration. When Ajahn Chah died, I think it was at night time or when the monks weren't looking, lay people dug up the septic tanks by Ajahn Chah's hut to sift through the feces looking for relics. Yeah, so the septic tanks are just down there, you can ask. Is that the case, Scotty?
Yeah, good.
Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I'm opening it up. Smell it.
And you will see the amazing truth that it smells like every other. Okay, enough about that. Come on, let's go. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.